5 Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a team led by White House advisor Jared Kushner spent March and April coming up with a national COVID-19 testing program. We'll find out what they put together and why it was never put in place. First, we received a question from a listener about Latinx voters in Wisconsin. We asked her to join us for a few minutes to talk more about what she's curious about in our Wisconsin project. Eloisa Gomez is with us from Milwaukee. Eloisa, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob. And I just want to say thanks so much to WPR for following up on my question.
Sure. That's why we do this Wisconsin thing. I'm glad you asked your question. Eloisa, before we get to your question, I understand you do some work around voting with the Latinx community in the Milwaukee area. What kind of things do you do?
Oh, well, yes, through my work with the League of Women Voters of Milwaukee County, we're focusing in on the south side of Milwaukee, in which we're providing a lot of bilingual literature and making it culturally appropriate to really attract attention and to be able to provide nonpartisan information so people make good decisions about when they vote.
What are some of the key issues or maybe even obstacles facing the voters you're working with in the community?
Well, one of the big obstacles especially for our Spanish-speaking portion of our Latino community is just access to the information in Spanish. We just have such a long ways to go in providing information in Spanish. So through the League of Women Voters, we've been working to make that available. In fact, now we're going to have all the candidate information that's put on by the League of Women Voters, you know, the questions that they, standard questions they ask candidates, is now available in Spanish completely. So we're very excited about that. But that's just one matter. I just think we're often thinking of the Latino voters at the time of the election, when it really has to be an ongoing kind of effort.
All right. Now set us up for a conversation. What, Eloisa, is your Wisconsin question?
Okay. Thank you. So here's my question. The 2020 election are a historic milestone for Latinx voters in the U.S. At 13.3%, the Latino population has the largest share of the electorate among minority voting population. How is this changing demographic changing electoral politics now and in the future? More specifically, how does this trend translate to the level of the city of Milwaukee, which has the largest concentration of Latinos in the state of Wisconsin?
All right, Eloisa, thank you so much for coming on the air to share your question. I appreciate it.
Oh, I appreciate you all so much. Thank you.
We'll turn now to two guests to help us answer that question. We've got Phil Chen, assistant professor of political science at Beloit College. Phil, welcome back to Central Time.
Happy to be here, Rob.
And Jaime Alvarado is a state board secretary for the League of United Latin American Citizens, Wisconsin. Jaime, thanks a lot for joining us.
Pleasure being here. Thank you.
Let's start with you, Jaime. Can you tell us a little bit about the role you at this group, LULAC, see Latinx voters playing in Milwaukee and around Wisconsin?
Well, yeah, I've been a LULAC member for over 10 years. And LULAC, by the way, is a League of United Latin American Citizens. We're an advocacy group similar to the NAACP for Latinos. We advocate for housing, education, civil rights, and a big part is registering voters. And so we've been registering voters for the past 8 years in the Milwaukee area, specifically at the DMV. In the near south side, which is the Latino neighborhood. And that's the biggest obstacle I see is registering our community and learning about the the importance of voting, but also when are the election dates and the candidates, give you an inform who the candidates are. And the League of Women Voters, by the way, has a really great website where you can learn in a nonpartisan way what their issues are. And that's what we want, is to educate our community and to be well-informed and to go out and vote.
And Jaime, getting to Eloisa's question, the first part of it, she says that this is a milestone moment this year for Latinx voters and their percentage of the electorate and their possible sway on the elections. Does that sound about right to you?
Yeah. You know, nationwide, 1 million Latinos are turning 18 and eligible to vote. In the city of Milwaukee, 25% of our students at MPS are Latinos. And the median age of all Latinos in the U.S. is 19, so 35 million U.S.-born Latinos. So it's a huge potential. The next two decades, Latinos will be a very important part of making decisions on who are elected officials nationwide. And Milwaukee is no exception.
And Phil, let's turn to you now. Do we see notable voting patterns or voting behaviors from this the Latinx community, the people here in Wisconsin, that we can start your part of the conversation off with?
So I think the big thing to remember here is that when we're talking about the Latinx community and Latinx voters, we also have to consider other competing identities or intersecting identities. And one of the big things is age, right? We've heard both Jaime and Eloisa speak about age and Latinx voters, you know, turning 18. Well, the problem is that we know that young people vote at significantly lower rates than older people. And so the effort going in from LULAC around registration and the League of Women Voters for Spanish language, that's all a really important piece of getting people engaged with the process. But it's also about turning out those younger voters. And that's always been a challenge for both political parties. And so that's what I think we're going to be looking for, is how can the candidates turn out those younger Latinx voters?
Another complicating factor here is Latinx or Latino, whichever phrase we use, covers a lot of diversity. That could mean a Puerto Rican or could mean Cuban American. It could mean, you know, first generation immigrants. It could be families that have been in, say, New Mexico since the 1600s. There are a lot of different subgroups here, Phil, that may not all feel the same way about the different issues.
Absolutely. And I think there's a tendency in sort of the general public to think of Latinx or Latino voters as sort of a homogenous group. But the evidence we have suggests that that's not the case, that we really do need to think about Latinx voters the way we think about voters in general. They have issues they care about. Yes, immigration does tend to be somewhat of a wedge issue, but it does not always. In fact, it's not usually the most important issue among Latinx voters. And like you said, a Latino voter in New Mexico who's a longtime citizen, whose family has lived in New Mexico for years, is different than a naturalized citizen in California versus a citizen born in Milwaukee. And so there are regional differences, the same way that there are regional and class-based and education-based differences among white voters. We talk about those different influences on white voters all the time, and yet the general public tends to group Latinx voters and African-American voters and minority voters in general as these sort of homogenous groups, when in fact that's not really what we see as far as support. One of the sort of classic examples is Cuban-American voters in Florida tend to be significantly more conservative than other Latinx voters. And so when you talk about the sort of voter registration patterns and voting patterns of Latinx voters in Florida, you see a skew, and a large part of that is historical legacies of the Republican Party connected to Cuba that have driven Cuban Americans to be a little bit more Republican or a little more conservative than other Latinx subgroups.
And Jaime, with all that in mind, is it tough for you as an organization to find, I guess, common ground, common principles that might unite these different communities, these different age groups and so on that Phil was just talking about?
Yeah, I'm looking at some surveys show that the economy is a huge part, jobs. And incidentally, as far as Cubans, the newer generation are not as conservative, mm-hmm. and exactly. In Florida and around. So they're very, very in tune on what's happening with COVID now and the government and the spread of misinformation and hate. And so I think that's something that many are looking at, especially the youth, Black Lives Matter, things like that are galvanizing.
We're talking about Latinx voters in Wisconsin with Phil Chen from Beloit College and Jaime Alvarado of LULAC, Wisconsin, the League of United Latin American Citizens, answering a Wisconsin question from a WPR listener about the role of Latinx voters in Wisconsin elections, in American elections. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, questions, and maybe experiences. What questions do you have about Latinx voters in the Wisconsin electorate? Do you think that the state, that parties or candidates are doing enough to reach people with voting information, whether that's in Spanish or in English or just with community outreach? Call in at 800-642-1234. If you're a member of one of the communities we're talking about, love to hear your perspective on politics. 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up the conversation about how Latinx voters in Wisconsin might be changing electoral politics in the state and nationally. It comes from a WPR listener question as part of our Why Wisconsin project. We've got political science professor Phil Chen from Beloit College with us and Jaime Alvarado, state board secretary for LULAC Wisconsin, the Latin American Civil Rights Organization. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you and your community? Are you a Latinx resident of Wisconsin? What are some issues that matter to you as a voter? For anyone out there, do you have questions about the changing demographics of Wisconsin and the nation and how it all plays out politically? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Jaime, let's get into part of Eloise's question now about Milwaukee in particular. Can you talk about the changing demographics there and what that looks like for local politics there?
Yeah, like I mentioned, 25% of MPS students are Latino, and the population is young. So, League of Women Voters and LULAC are heavily into high schools and registering voters and the youth. And one thing that we're following up is with texting and messaging. And I think that's going to make the difference. I think it's going to make a bigger turnout, giving them information on who the candidates are, nonpartisan information that the League Women Voters have, and other sources. I think is important to be informed. So I think that's going to make a difference on many many campaigns, elections.
And Phil, the proportion of the population we're talking about, the U.S. population, about 16-ish%, depending on how you slice it, but they're not evenly distributed around the country. Can you talk about how Latinx voters, in certain states, in certain congressional districts, in certain electoral vote tallying areas might be a swing factor?
Yeah, absolutely. So Pew Research just earlier this year came out with a study that showed, over basically 60-ish% of the what we might think of naturalized citizens, or what we know of as naturalized citizens, live in five states. And this isn't just Latinos or Latinx immigrants. This is naturalized citizens. But they live in California, New York, Florida, Texas, and New Jersey. And so this, I think, is reproduced in some way in what we see around other immigrant voting blocks, as well as around the Latinx voting block, right? That they're, like you said, it's not a group of voters that are randomly distributed. And so some of those states, California, New York, New Jersey, not really going to be in play. Texas, despite lots of talk, probably going to go Republican. But Florida is absolutely a swing state and is in play in the 2020 election. But like you said, there's also issues around congressional representation. And what we know is that there's been historical gerrymandering drawn to reduce the influence of minority communities in and to, pack minorities into congressional districts. And we also know that immigrant status, as well as racial minority status, tends to correlate in this country with lower levels of mobility, of income, of education. Yes, some of that's changing, but that also leads to different kinds of geographic constraints. And so there's some real thorny issues that need to be overcome, both in the way that districts are drawn, as well as the way that our social safety net is developed, in order to see a more sort of, I don't want to say random distribution, but a broader distribution of minority voters across the country that isn't so packed into certain states or certain congressional districts.
Jaime, given the potential influence of Latinx voters in key districts, do you see politicians and parties making an effort to reach out?
Most definitely. And I'd like to add Arizona, Nevada, Illinois. A lot of those congressional districts are going to be changed with the Latino vote, all over the country for the most part in metropolitans. And they're also going into the suburbs. A lot of Latinos are in the suburbs as well. So, I think the campaigns are definitely going to be, both Republican and Democratic campaigns are going to try and court the very important Latino vote.
We are talking to Jaime Alvarado, State Board Secretary for the League of United Latin American Citizens, Wisconsin, and Phil Chen, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Beloit College. They are helping answer a Wisconsin question from one of our listeners, Eloisa Gomez, about the role of Latinx voters around the country here in Wisconsin and at the local level. You can always share questions with our Wisconsin project, by the way, at WPR.org. Phil, politically, I think there's been an assumption sometimes from Democrats that as Latinx populations go up in key areas, that's inherently good news for Democrats. You mentioned a state like Texas, where it seems like Democrats in particular have been holding their breath for this to happen, that change to happen for some time. It's not necessarily something they can bank on, right?
Right. I mean, so what we do know is that Latinx voters do tend to identify as more Democratic than white voters. So in some sense, yes, a larger voting block that is made up of more Latinx voters than in the previous year should tend mathematically to be a little bit more Democratic. But states like Texas are tricky. Texas has not gone Democratic the way that many people have predicted. It may be moving that way in the sense that Texas tends to be getting a little bit more competitive, but we haven't really seen statewide elections go to the Democrats too much in Texas. That's not to say that the sort of Latinx community might not become a really solid Democratic voting bloc. They're already, again, not to paint with too broad a brush, but the Latinx community voters are still at this point largely Democratic, but not nearly to the extent that we see, for instance, with African-American voters, where we see consistently 80 to 90% of African-American voters voting for the Democratic presidential candidate. It's more along the lines of 60, 65% of Latinx voters. Doesn't mean that the nature of party coalitions won't change over time. In fact, it's likely that that will change, but it's not, there isn't sort of the same historical legacy around, say, the Civil Rights Act in the 1960s, or just the way the Democratic Party has positioned itself with African-American voters. We don't have quite the same history with Latinx voters that the Democrats can necessarily count on this as a consistent voting bloc without much more effort to reach out to these communities, to register them, to stay engaged on a variety of issues that are important to them throughout the years, not just when it comes time for an election.
Jaime, I wanted to ask you about something that Phil had mentioned earlier, concerns of gerrymandering, drawing district lines, especially in ways that limit the voting impact of minority communities. Is that something you're concerned about here in Wisconsin, in particular, as we get ready to draw new district lines after the 2020 census?
Yeah. I was part of the redistricting in the Milwaukee, the city of Milwaukee, and there again, it was also packed and cracked. And the legislative maps are the same. Unfortunately, it's a partisan mapping now, gerrymandering type of system. So So until we get independent type of system where maps are drawn, it will make a difference. You look at the statistics where the one party gets the majority of the votes, but they got a lot less seats. And that's a prime example of the broken system we have in Wisconsin.
And Phil, bringing it back around to Eloise's question that we started with, she also talks about the future. I won't ask you to predict the future, but can you talk about the potential for rising influence of Latinx voters, not just in 2020, but in the years to come?
Absolutely. And I think cycling back to a lot of what both Jaime and Eloisa have said, the way that we should probably, the way at least that I think we should think about the rising influence of Latinx voters is through the lens of age as well. Young people, the increased influence of younger people, this youngest generation, which is the most diverse generation in U.S. history. That's where the power will come from. That's not to say that older Latinx voters don't also have power. But as we think about the change in electoral coalitions, the change in how elections work in this country, we should be thinking about the power of that youngest generation and the issues they care about. And when we look at those issues, we see those issues are things like education, are things like the economy, having jobs available to young people, being able, the environment is a major issue. These are issues that are cutting across racial, demographic lines in a way that really, I think, will drive home that point and that change that that Eloisa is referring to in her question.
We'll leave it there for now. Phil, thanks for joining us today.
Of course, happy to be here.
And Jaime, thanks a lot for being with us.
Pleasure. My pleasure.
We've been talking to Jaime Alvarado, State Board Secretary for the group LULAC Wisconsin, the League of United Latin American Citizens, and Phil Chen, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Beloit College. We talked to them about Latinx voters in Wisconsin. This conversation inspired by a question from listener Eloisa Gomez, who we talked to at the beginning of the conversation as part of the Why Wisconsin Project. Submit your question, and we might take a stab at answering it in the future. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. That's like W-H-Y, Wisconsin. Coming up, we'll find out how the plan for a nationwide COVID-19 testing program developed by President Trump's son-in-law got scrapped and what's that meant for the spread of the disease. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up in just a little bit, we'll take your calls. How are you enjoying the outdoors during this unusual summer season? First, most industrialized countries have responded to the coronavirus outbreak with a national testing program. The United States hasn't, opting instead to let states handle testing operations on their own. Many public health experts say that that's hampered our ability to get the COVID-19 pandemic under control. New reporting shows that a group working under White House advisor Jared Kushner did put together an outline of a national testing program during March and April. For reasons that aren't entirely clear, that idea was never put into place. Catherine Eben is an investigative journalist and a contributing editor at Vanity Fair. She's the author of the book Bottle of Lies, The Inside Story of the Generic Drug Boom. Catherine, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Great to be on with you. Thank you.
Well, there's that compare and contrast. A lot of countries did, most countries in the industrial world did have a national program. We didn't. What is the advantage when you talk to public health experts of having a nationwide testing policy?
Yeah. It was very clear to sort of every public health expert that testing plan would be absolutely required. I mean, if you want to scale up testing, have adequate amount of supplies, have adequate amount of testing sites and get results back in a rapid way and then trace the contacts of people who test positive, there is a lot of coordination that needs to happen. This is not just a state-by-state issue, but the problem was, even though, as I uncovered, a national testing plan was developed by a team assembled by Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law, that plan was actually killed.
Right. We had that big press conference where there was talk of, Google making up this screening thing, and we're going to have testing in lots of, parking lots of businesses and things like that. It never materialized. I want to dive into that plan, though, that you write about from Jared Kushner, presidential advisor and son-in-law. Who was on this team that he pulled together?
Well, you know, when he first assembled this team to, quote unquote, solve the diagnostic testing crisis, the group that he assembled didn't actually have any experience with diagnostic testing. It was his associates. It was a college roommate. It was a Morgan Stanley banker. And that group began reaching out to various billionaires who also did not have diagnostic testing experience. What changed it was that the group then reached out to diagnostic testing experts, and together they hammered out a comprehensive national plan. And what that would have done was surge supplies and help allocate those supplies, as well as allocating lab capacity, right? What we're seeing right now is lab people are waiting over 7 days for test results, which makes the tests useless. This plan would have solved that, and it essentially resembles the kind of testing plan that most industrialized nations have set up, especially the countries that have flattened their curves. They have nationalized testing plans.
And you heard from some people involved in this that they thought this plan was going to be the plan, right? They thought they were creating something that ultimately the president was going to sign off on and put into place.
Absolutely. They were basically told that it was a go. They were expecting an announcement. And then, as one participant said to me, the plan just went poof into thin air.
What do we know about what happened, why the federal plan was scrapped, and why it went to a state plan with maybe some backstop from the feds?
Right. So our understanding from the reporting is that this plan, which was supposed to be announced in early April, essentially hit shifting sentiment at the White House. There was a belief, which was erroneous, that the virus was on its way out. It was subsiding. You know, there was an assumption that this plan was going to be a huge effort to stand up. And at that point, the virus was pretty much just affecting the blue states. And so there was a sense that a national plan, number one, would not have political resonance. And that also it wasn't required because as a political solution to the problem, they could just blame Democratic governors and leave it at that. And of course, it was a gamble that worked out very badly, because now we're seeing the virus is rampant in the red states. And we've all seen the images this summer of miles long lines of cars waiting in the heat, people trying to get tested, can't get tested, can't get results. And that presumably is what this plan would have solved.
We're talking to Catherine Eben from Vanity Fair, a piece she wrote about an effort led by Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law, to create a federal testing program in the earlier days of the COVID-19 pandemic. The plan ultimately scrapped. She looked into some of the reasons behind that. Catherine, you reached out to a White House spokesperson for comment. What kind of things did you hear back?
Well, the White House's response has been that the piece is completely false, that it is based on, you know, erroneous assumptions. So they've, you know, tried to push back against the story pretty hard. But, you know, there isn't anything that they have elaborated on that explains, you know, we obtained a copy of the plan. We obtained a copy of an invoice of testing kits that were ordered by the White House and then turned out to be contaminated and unusable. And these were testing kits that were shipped from the United Arab Emirates. So, you know, nothing in their comment sort of explains any of that.
I want to dig into that strange load of testing supplies from the United Arab Emirates.
Yeah.
First of all, you have a copy of this invoice that actually raises a lot more questions than it answers. What are some of the mysteries just found in this one piece of paper?
Yeah. I mean, this is really a striking invoice. And it was, you know, when I obtained it, I was really confounded. The company Cogna Technology Solutions is a subsidiary of a sort of shadowy artificial intelligence company from the United Arab Emirates, which has close ties to the ruling family. The test kits are Chinese-made diagnostic test kits that they ordered on behalf of the White House. These testing kits were shipped to the embassy of the United Arab Emirates. And then what happened next is really interesting because there was no legitimate contract for these. There was just this, you know, invoice with client name WH, the White House. And actually, the tests couldn't even be paid for because they were procured inappropriately. And they turned out to be contaminated. And an FDA spokesperson said to me that it may be because they were shipped from the Middle East and the reagents in the test kits were not kept cold, which they have to be. So, I mean, this was just sort of, you know, a blunder on top of a, you know, a mystery as to what happened to this plan and why it vanished.
Now, in the absence of a directed federal testing program, you write that some nonprofit groups and public health people outside of the federal system are trying to step up and take the place. What are we seeing out there?
Yeah, so the Rockefeller Foundation has stepped up with real urgency. They are trying to build a coalition of cities and states and tribal nations to get the United States to 30 million tests a week by the fall. And basically what they say is the only way to safely reopen schools and reopen the economy is to have incredibly widespread testing with rapid results. You know, the logic is you can't fight what you don't see. And so if we are to know where outbreaks are, we need access to these tests, because if you don't have access to them, your only remedy is a blunt instrument of shutdowns, right? But you could be much more targeted about that if you actually knew where the outbreaks were.
We've seen testing numbers go up in the United States. Did I just hear you say the 30 million tests a week would be their target?
That is their target. That's right, for the fall, for October.
I'm looking at the CDC. I'm looking at the CDC webpage. We've had just shy of 53 million tests through all of this. So that would be a huge ramp up.
It's a huge ramp up. We are right now at about 5.5 million tests a week. And, you know, let me say one other thing about this, which is President Trump is always touting the sheer number of tests. So America does do a lot of tests. But the issue is not just the number of tests. It's what you do with those tests. How quickly do the results come back, right? The test, the purpose of the test is to get information you can act on. So in countries where they've been very successful in doing testing, like South Korea, they're returning results within 24 hours. Then they have a system of contact tracing and a system of supportive quarantine or isolation where they do food drop-offs for people who are quarantined. You know, so it's not just the fact of a test. It's the turnaround time for the tests and what you do when you get a positive result.
As we wrap up, when you talk to experts about our current state-by-state approach in effect, so what are their concerns about that in the months to come?
I mean, as one expert said to me, the diagnostic testing industry is this loosely constructed web, and COVID-19 is a stage 5 hurricane. And, you know, what they're anticipating actually is that the fall is possibly or likely going to be even worse than the spring, because that's when you have school reopenings. That's when you have flu season. How are we going to distinguish between the flu and COVID-19, right? If you don't have any way to do that through testing, then all you have is shutdowns. So there is a lot of concern around that.
Catherine, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on. It was a pleasure.
Catherine Eben is an investigative journalist and a contributing editor at Vanity Fair. She talked to us about her latest story detailing a national testing plan from a team led by White House advisor Jared Kushner, an idea that ultimately disappeared. Coming up, we'll turn to a lighter topic, and we want to hear from you. We'll ask how you have been enjoying the outdoors during this weird summer. Camping, gardening, walks, short or long walks, quiet drives, fishing. Give us a call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll take your calls about how you're finding ways to enjoy the outdoors coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the digital economy has given us lots of access to creative work, but the author of a new book says it's come at a big cost to the creators themselves. Now, the coronavirus has put a big dent into a lot of people's summer plans. Backyard barbecues have been put on hold or much less capacity and attendance at them. Traveling has made a lot of people squeamish. No Brewers games to go to in person. A bunch of summer events and festivities, like the state fair slated to begin this week, have been canceled or at least scaled back. When you actually do something, you got to be mindful about keeping your distance, wearing the mask, being more diligent about cleanliness and hygiene. But you can still do stuff, especially outside, and we've still got a bunch of summer left. So now we want to hear from you. How have you been making the best of the situation? What are you doing outside? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. How have you been enjoying the outdoors? Anything outdoorsy on your list for the next couple few weeks? Where in Wisconsin have you spent time outside? Do you have a favorite park to visit? Favorite activity? What's the most fun you've had this summer under the open sky? Near or a little bit far. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I asked around the Central Time team. They let me know some cool stuff they've been doing. Bill Martin's producer says he built a pretty spiffy mailbox garden this summer. He says it's the nicest one on the street. He and his wife are reaping the harvest from their big raised garden in the backyard, too. Lots of tomatoes, and he says he's been doing a lot of photography and taking early morning walks in the neighborhood. Producer Tim Peterson and his wife and a couple of friends and associated dogs recently hiked, physically distanced, around the Natural Bridge State Park in North Freedom. There's actually a pretty rad natural bridge there. That was actually the first natural park I visited when I moved to Wisconsin those many years ago. Our executive producer, Judith Sears Poisson, has been inspired by seeing friends' social media posts about exploring new-to-them places close to home. She's making a list of those suggestions and exploring them when she can. On Sunday, she visited a lovely conservancy, she says, just west of Madison that's being restored as an oak savanna. Well, now, how about you? How have you found ways to enjoy the summer at 800-642-1234? That's 800-642-1234. 1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Waiting for a couple callers to come in. There we go. We've got Mike on the line in Franklin. Mike, hi.
Hi, Rob. How are you doing?
Good. What do you want to tell us about? What are you doing outside?
Like I was telling your screener, I used to do a lot of runs during the year. And since those got canceled, a lot of the training that I would do with running on some of the trails in the area, down by the lakefront, things like that, I haven't done those. And a real easy way for me to keep distance and still get some exercise has been biking. One of the things that I've done is there have been some challenges that have been put out by the Trek Bike Company. And so, you know, they're trying to, you know, do 100 miles or 500 miles or 1,000 miles in the month. So one of the things that I did is my brother and I got together, and he lives in Mequon, and we took the interurban trail that actually goes all the way up to Port Washington. So we got a chance to see the marina up there, got a chance to see a lot of places that you normally wouldn't see, you know, along the trail because awesome. You're off the major highway. So and we got some really good exercise as a result of it. So that's been really fun.
Fantastic. It's a win-win. Mike, thanks a lot for getting us started at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Madeline now in Lake Geneva. Madeline, hi.
Hi there. How are you today?
Great. What did you want to tell us about Madeline?
So a couple of weeks ago, we took a drive north and west from Lake Geneva to a place called La Crosse, Wisconsin. But prior to getting there, we went to the Driftless region, which I had never even known about. There are, I think, 20 square miles in the Driftless region of the state that allow people to access farmers' properties and be able to fish on the river. We actually fly fished, but people who were beginners that we were standing next to were picking trout out of these gorgeous rivers next to cows that were grazing next to us, and were complete beginners and had such a blast fishing. And then we found ourselves in La Crosse at a wonderful restaurant called The Waterfront, watching the Wisconsin River, and our first experience with steamships and barges going by. So
fantastic.
Our children had never even seen either of those spots in Wisconsin.
I love it. Great parts of the state, both of them. And yeah, I love seeing the barges go by on the Mississippi. Madeline, thank you so much for calling in. We are taking your calls about how you are enjoying the outdoors during this unusual summer. Still time for your call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Ben joins us now in Chippewa Falls. Ben, hello.
Hi there. Just a few days ago, I came back from 8 beautiful days in the Boundary Waters in northeastern Minnesota with my brother, my son, and my nephew. It was by far the best camping trip of my life, 31 miles by kayak and canoe, and we made it out alive. Great time, and it was all outdoors, no phones, no anything, and it was great time.
That sounds fantastic. Any food highlights for your campfire cookery, Ben?
Lots of bass, just fried in a little bit of butter with some cornmeal and potatoes. A lot of potatoes. Quite a few potatoes.
Sounds fantastic. Potato packets and things like that. Ben, thank you so much for calling in at 800-642-1234. Our technical director, Sarah Hopeful, has been doing a lot of camping herself, biking and hiking at state parks. Even just going for a night or two feels like a mini vacation that's safe, she says. Time for one more caller if we can get them ready. Dylan, yes, in Red Granite. Dylan, hi.
Hey, I've been spending my summer out and helping my local farmers out their fields and helping them raise some cows and stuff.
That's fantastic, Dylan. That sounds like a great, productive way to spend your summer, and you get outside too. Thanks so much for sharing that, Dylan, and thanks for all of your calls. Well, you can keep it going, by the way, over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let us know what you're doing, big or small, to get outside and enjoy the summer during an unusual, to say the least, summer travel season. Thanks for everybody to call in. Another 3 or 4 weeks now until the school year starts up again, so get out there and make the best of it. It looks like we've got pretty decent weather for the next few days. Sunshine, temperatures in the 70s and 80s, not a real big chance of rain, I understand, till the weekend. And by I understand, I mean weather nerd and producer Bill Martins tells me that. If you didn't get through on the air, email ideas@WPR.org, tweet us at Central Time WPR, or again, you can post over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. People who drink a lot of tea sometimes have very strong opinions about the best way to make tea. And one difference of opinion has led to a good-natured international dispute. An American on TikTok, the social media site, demonstrated a tea-making technique using microwaved water. Now, that got a bad reaction from, wait for it, you're never going to guess, England, where most tea fans say microwaved water is a no-go. It turned into kind of a thing. U.S. and British ambassadors weighed in on the debate, again, good-naturedly. Me now, I drink some tea, a little ginger tea, not really tea exactly during the show. Here it is. That's the mug. Hot tea occasionally, iced tea a lot in the summer. And I don't use microwaved water, even when it would be faster. I've tried it. It doesn't seem quite right, but I can never put my finger on why. Well, it turns out there's some science. As CNN reports, researchers in China have figured out the problem with microwaved water for tea. The problem, the microwave doesn't heat the water evenly. In your kettle, electric, or stovetop, there's convection. The water gets hot at the bottom, it moves up. Cooler stuff from the top moves down. It's a swirling thing. But in the microwave, there's not a heat source at the bottom. The water just kind of sits there. Some layers get hot, some not. These researchers developed a silver-plated microwave cup that helps make some convection. Supposedly, it's still safe for the microwave. But I think I'll stick with the old-fashioned kettle. It's tea news you can use. This is Central Time.